Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be interviewing James Corbett of the Corbett Report here right after or during the second and last segment of the program today. And so they will be here, and I am here for the first 20 minutes today, bringing you my opinion, my commentary on today's economic and political events for Thursday, August 14th, 2014. And also, I want to remind you folks, James Corbett of the Corbett Report, he was asked by Bob Chapman to carry on the tradition of the International Forecaster, and we do run specials for the newsletter, and certainly no one can replace Bob, but they really do a good job, and I know their heart's in it, and they try very hard, and James Corbett is very much a part of the International Forecaster as the lead writer for the publication. So we do run specials if you're interested for renewals, if you already have one, or if you're interested in obtaining one. And, of course, we run articles in there also. Give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And let's go ahead and get right into the market report today. Gold was up 70 cents today at $13.13.90. The high, $13.21. Give them enough time and, you know, they'll just whittle it back down. Silver's up 3 cents today at $19.93. And, of course, that high of the day was $20.08. Platinum was down two at $14.72, along with palladium up five at $886. The USDX today is down 0.03 at $81.57. And crude oil today took a bath. 2.25 down $2.26 at $95.33. In fact, I got gasoline today, and even though it just, I rarely wait for it ever to get close to being empty. It's just a little mind game I play with myself. I always, plus for security reasons, I never let it go below, you know, once it's down a quarter, I go and I fill it up, and usually it's $20 that costs me, not what it cost me today. But certainly was a lot lower than it was a week ago when I purchased gasoline and crude oil, 95.33 at 2.26. I'm not quite sure why that is. I knew they were going to run it, and they did. And I knew they were going to drop it. Now, you got a lot of you know, people making tons of money because they know exactly what's going to happen when it goes up and when it goes down. So they play both sides. They go long, they go short. So I'm not quite sure where oil is going to actually stop before we start see it moving back up. Could be 90. Could even break 90, but I think it likes the 90s. So I think that's been averaging that price for quite a while. So paper markets today. Let's bring that up. Low oil prices also. I mean, if you wanted to tie that to the economy, you could. Low demand. People just can't do anything, go anywhere. The heating season is coming up, and of course they should be making that transition in the refineries here shortly, but so we could tag it to the economy with the lack of demand, certainly here and around the world. You have the Dow up 61 points, and the Dow with those numbers certainly doesn't indicate a slow economy anywhere. Sounds like corporations are doing fantastic. Well, the major corporation that is behind the Dow, of course, is the Federal Reserve. So the Dow is 16,713. They have the NASDAQ up 18 at 44.53. The S&P up 8 at 19.54. But I still think you'll see NASDAQ 5,000. I think you'll still see the S&P at 2,000. The Dow, you know, will we hit 17,000 again? I don't think we'll go much higher than, you know, the old highs of the Dow. But certainly this is an election year, and they certainly can pull out anything that they can. You have the 10-year yield trading down 0.01. At 2.40%. And headline on my money page says that Warren Buffett's stock, his stock, Berkshire Hathaway, hit $200,000 a share. It's a milestone. They hit it today. And an old-time friend, a good friend, was going to college long, long time ago. And he says that's how he paid his way through college, by investing in the stock market. It was all short term. You know, he was in and out. He was probably one of the first day traders because that's how he financed his college. And he came across Berkshire Hathaway, and it was a little under $500. And he said he was going to putting himself through college, and he couldn't afford the $500 in order to buy it, but he thought it was an interesting stock. And of course, if he had, and he had stuck with it and bought a few of those shares, he'd be a very wealthy man. But anyway, what we have going on today, let's see here. Yeah, it feels funny not to have my sidekick here. You know, he does all the talking. I just, that's right, Al. Now, don't anybody tell him that. But we got some pretty interesting numbers coming out today, and we talked about the auto subprime loans. I believe it was yesterday or the day before. And the U.S. auto loans, which is no surprise, we talked about it, rose to its highest level since 2006, fueled by subprime lending. That came out by the New York Fed today. Said it jumped to the highest level in 8 years this spring. And, of course, it was a big increase in lending to riskier borrowers. And again, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York said that the loan to these borrowers was shoddy credit. And these folks make up where the credit report is 620 and below. So those are some pretty low credit scores. And the federal banking regulators, of course, are concerned. The rapid increase in these subprime auto loans, and of course they're concerned about leading to more defaults and of course harming those precious banks and of course consumers. I don't think you can compare auto loans to mortgage loans to 2008. However, our economy, our banking system is much more fragile today than it was in 2008. So these auto loans, if these subprime loans begin to unfold all at once, I think it could have just as a big impact along when we bring in the student loans. And that's the we'll talk about the three biggest debts in this country, and of course they're number two. So again, with this type of the auto loans, it's very big and it could have a major impact on the system. And what they do to these auto loans is they package them up into securities and sell them to investors, just like they did the mortgage loans. And of course, kind of reminds me of derivatives, doesn't it, to you? But anyway, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency said the signs of increasing risk are evident in the auto lending. They found that lenders are making larger car loans. We talked about this yesterday, too. The banks are lending money on higher valued automobiles, not the 6,000 and 8,000 and 10,000. They really want you to get in there at the 20,000 plus loans. And of course, because of the size of the loans, will have a bigger impact. And as a result, the size of car loans in default, that has also increased in the past 2 years. General Motors' financing arm over at subprime lending is being investigated by the Justice Department. The New York Fed report pretty much stopped short of recommending specific steps. In a separate post on its website, New York Fed economist said they would continue to monitor the issues. Of course. Banks and other lenders issued $101 billion in new auto loans in the April to June quarter. Total outstanding auto loans rose to $905 billion in the second quarter. Auto loans are the third largest source of Americans' debt after mortgages and student loans. Mortgage debt actually declined in the second quarter to $8.1 trillion, while student debt rose to $1.12 trillion. And Americans have $669 billion on their credit cards. And we all know that the mortgage lending is weakening, or it did weaken in the second quarter to the slowest pace in 14 years. Now, does any of this really sound like a good economy, like the economy is really being in a recovery? And because the mortgage lending weakened, that includes both mortgages for purchase and refinancing. Now, when it comes to mortgage loans, they did tighten their credit standards a little bit, but certainly not to the degree as what they probably should, because they need people in order to buy homes. The Fed's data shows that the dollar amount of subprime auto loans, defined as loans to borrowers with credit scores below 620, and it has nearly doubled since 2010. For borrowers in the two most creditworthy categories, defined as those with scores above 720. So, doesn't sound like a rosy scenario to me, but of course, this is certainly where we're headed. Now, we often talk about bad news on this program, and I think here we have some good news, perhaps not for the right reason. Maybe it's the bad news that has generated the good news, because it's based on a poor economy, but the result, I think, is good. And this comes from from Raleigh, North Carolina. North Carolina, their officials say that there's been a huge increase over the past 2 years in the number of families who have pulled their kids out of public school and begun educating them at home. The number of homeschools has jumped 27% since the 2011-12 school year. As of last year, 98,172 North Carolinian children were homeschooled. That's 2,400 students more than the number who attended a private school. And so while the sputtering economy is the reason families are choosing homeschooling over private schooling, the nationalized learning experiment, Common Core, is the main reason families are leaving the public schools in the first place. That is good news. Common Core is a big factor that he hears that Beth Herbert, founder of Lighthouse Christian Homeschool Association, she says that is Common Core is a big factor that she hears people talk about. They're not happy with the work their kids are coming home with, and they've decided to take their children home. In the No Parents Understand that Common Core's plotting approach to math instruction leaves students unprepared for college study in STEM courses, science, technology, engineering, and math. And it's these same parents also realize that the nationalized learning standards emphasis of nonfiction informational texts over classic literature is intended to mold students into drone-like workers, not out-of-the-box thinkers. And for homeschool parents, it's the Common Core-related standardized testing that they're trying to protect their kids from. And whatever the particular reason, it all adds up to a very significant exodus from the public schools. Homeschooling doesn't mean kids have to miss all the social and they get all that. They can still have their extracurricular activities with the community, as the traditional schools do. So homeschooling, it was legalized by the Supreme Court in 1985. And, of course, that was before Common Core came into effect. So good news, North Carolina. It's a great thing to see this many. I'd like to see the rest of the states follow suit to that degree, and perhaps they will. So good news. And we'll be heading to break here in just a few moments. I just want to remind listeners, we've got some great specials. We have a limited amount. So if you want to get in on the deal, you need to call right after the program or right after I'm off the air. We have some 1 ounce gold eagle coins coming in at a very reduced price, $1,350, $1,350. Again, a limited amount. So if you're interested, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. We have some Mint State 63 $20 gold pieces, limited amount on those, for $1,595. For Mint State 63 $20 gold pieces, and on that, it does include your shipping cost. And remember, we still have a 1 ounce silver eagle going out with all orders for the rest of this month. And so we got some other great specials. We have some AU $5 Liberty gold pieces. And I'm still getting asked many, many times over and over again what I think about the little chip bars, the little grams of gold that come in credit card size, protection where you can put it in your wallet or even the Vicambi bars. And again, folks, you always want to purchase things that are recognizable and acceptable. You don't want to get caught up fever of the pitch thinking that by buying the grams and that you can carry it around in your wallet that it's going to be a great bartering tool. If you put that one of those little grams in one hand and a little coin like a 1/10 ounce gold eagle piece, 1/10 of an ounce of gold, and has a $5 face value on, what do you think most people will want? Of course, they're going to choose the $5, 1/10 ounce gold American eagle. Who knows what's in those little grams and who are you going to sell it to? I mean, you'll always want to sell your gold and silver into the market first and get the current rate of exchange. I mean, that's what you always want. You can carry around a 1/10 ounce gold coin in your wallet. You want to protect it. Yeah, there's little plastic flips you can put in there. You can carry around a little 90% silver, a 50-cent piece, or even a Morgan silver dollar, which we also have in inventory at some fantastic prices. Very nice-looking Morgan silver dollars, pre-1921. Much better than walking around with those grams. And you think you're getting a deal. And what's sad is they pitch it to people who really should be buying silver. And if you don't have enough money at one time to buy a 10-ounce gold eagle coin, save up for it and purchase it, because in the long run, you'll get much, much more of your money returned back to you. So we're going to break here. The interview with Alfred and James Corbett will be joining just as soon as the end of the break.
prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival. Our guest is James Corbett. He's been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, the weekly e-newsletter created by recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. You can find the Corbett Report at CORBETTReport.com. CORBETTReport.com. Good evening, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Thank you very much for having me on, as always.
Always glad to have you on. Let me see where we'll go with this. Here's a little article we've got from AFP. Japan protests Russian drills on disputed islands. The article says Japan lodged a stern protest with Russia Wednesday over military exercises that are being held on the disputed Kuril Islands. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but Kuril, K-U-R-I-L. Moscow launched drills on Tuesday in the long-contested islands, which are located off Russia's far eastern coast and just north of Japan. It goes back and forth. The reason this is interesting to me is we've got Japan issuing stern protests to China who will control the Senkaku Islands. And now, after jumping on Russia with some additional economic sanctions, Japan is issuing more stern protests to Russia over who's going to control the Kuril Islands to the north. So it seems to me Japan has enough economic troubles of its own and shouldn't be meddling further with Russia. That would be one lesson in this. And I'm curious, do you think Russia's response by having a military exercise on these northern islands, is this just tit for tat, no big thing? Or does it signal something more significant? And if so, is this evidence of a possible alliance between China and Russia that's perhaps contrary to Japan's best interest?
Well, that's a lot to bite off and chew, but I would say that regardless of whether or not this is a mere tit-for-tat or something of a larger agenda, I think it certainly is an escalation of tensions between Japan and Russia, which are at a low at the moment. And as you alluded to, I think part of what is happening here is Russia not only taking some of the brinksmanship that has been foisted on it in Eastern Europe, but now putting some of that back out into the world. And specifically, I'm talking, of course, about the recent food ban that Russia has placed on the EU, America, Canada, Australia, a lot of the U.S. allies, that is going to be a significant sanction. It's going to bite into the agricultural industry of Europe and of America and Canada, Australia, other countries quite significantly, with billions of dollars of losses in each of those industries. So that, I think, was actually a pretty key part in this entire ramp up of tensions between Japan and Russia, between the U.S. and Russia, and the EU and Russia, because I think there was a point at which the American imperial hegemon was such that it could wield its power in any way that it wanted and really apply sanctions any way that it wanted against any country that it wanted, and those sanctions would generally be pretty definitive in terms of bringing whatever tensions were there to a close, usually on the side of the U.S. interests. But I think what Russia did by putting this reverse sanction on is completely flip that script in a way that's, and it's certainly not going to cause the global economy to collapse, but it is significant, and it will bite into industries in America and abroad. And that's significant because, again, I think it shows that Putin, to a certain extent, is not simply just going to be reacting and not simply be on the defensive. He's actually going to put the ball back in the court of the people who are lining up against him. So I think this has to be seen in that context as just Russia ramping this up even further. And as to the question of Russia and China and whether or not they're bedfellows and what that might mean for Japan, I'm somewhat skeptical of the idea that Russia and China are anything more than allies of convenience at this point. There has certainly been a lot of tensions between them in the past, and those tensions are easing, and they certainly are more involved in mutually beneficial associations like the BRICS, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. But I wouldn't say that they're necessarily buddy-buddies and that they necessarily are on the same page on various issues. In fact, I was just refamiliarizing myself with a really interesting story that came out last December in which China was pledging its security support to the Ukraine back at the time that Yanukovych was still in power before the coup in Kiev had ousted him, where they were pledging not only not to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine, which I'm not sure why they had to pledge that, why China would even, you know, that would even be an issue. But they were also pledging to provide security should anyone use nuclear weapons in Ukraine, which is, I mean, it's bizarre that Ukraine was effectively placed under the military umbrella of China at that time, because China, of course, is concerned about the idea of anyone affecting the territorial sovereignty of any other country. It's part of what China promotes on the world stage is that every country is completely territorially an integral unit and cannot be breached, which is why I think it diverges from Russia on a lot of these big geopolitical issues. It diverges in Syria and in Ukraine and in other places where China really wants no interference, no outside intervention by any party whatsoever. And I think that's a point of tension between Russia and China. So I'm somewhat skeptical of the idea that Russia and China are really banding together. But at any rate, their interests converge at certain points. And I think Japan has to at least be wary of the fact that they at least have a couple of flanks going on right now in their territorial disputes.
Yeah, and one of the questions is Russia's reaction, first off, Russia is showing, look, you're not going to push us around. You mess with us, we're going to mess with you. You sanction us, we're going to threaten your little islands. All right, so if you want to have fun, let's have fun. But Russia's not backing down. Now, is Putin's refusal to back down on this, do you think this is because Putin is merely obstinate and he's got an ego and a reputation maintained? Or do you think that Putin thinks he's in the right and that what happened in starting in the Ukraine wasn't his fault, he didn't make it, and he's going to do what he thinks, and he's going to respond to an injustice he's suffered? What do you think, what motivates him if it's even an either or? Is it an either or, or is it both obstinance and a sense of righteousness? What do you think?
Well, I don't think I'm in a position to psychologize Putin to that degree, but at any rate, I think we can look at the sort of political motivations for this. And I would say that there is, I mean, there's a couple of motivations that I don't think are exclusive. Certainly, this does play to Putin's base of support among a large degree of the Russian population that does see this as a point of, you know, national pride, that they are standing up to the outside powers in Ukraine and defending people who see themselves as ethnically Russian in eastern Ukraine. So there is a point of national pride that plays well into Putin's base of political support. And also, I mean, there is, I think, the sense at this point that Russia, I mean, understands that they have to react in some way more than simply reacting to the situation, which is, of course, what has sort of led them over the past couple of decades to the degradation of that agreement that that was offered back in the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, that there would be no NATO encroachment on Ukraine. There would be no NATO encroachment on former Soviet republics at all. And of course, that's been eroded. And, you know, now more and more of the surrounding territories have been taken over by NATO. And now we have Ukraine, perhaps potentially on the verge of becoming a NATO partner in some form and conducting joint military exercises and the like. So I think there is the sense that something has to be done proactively to at least bring this issue to a head. And I really don't think at this point that Putin is insane enough to believe that he would win some sort of direct military confrontation. But perhaps he is hoping that by, as you say, not backing down, that he would be able to get the other side to back away when they realize that he really is willing to put Russia's might behind these sanctions and really react to this in a meaningful way.
Do you think the military exercise on the islands north of Japan, do you think that's intended only to intimidate Japan? Or is it also to send a signal to Europe and say, look, we're not afraid of any of you, right? And maybe you guys in Europe had better not impose any more sanctions. Christmas time is coming, and it's going to get cold in your part of the world, and you're going to need some, you know, natural gas. Better pull in your horns. Is this only intended to intimidate Japan, or is it also intended to send a message to Europe?
Well, again, I think this has to be seen as part of a bigger picture that includes a lot of military exercises that have been taking place in Russia recently, and a lot of them directed towards that border region next to Ukraine. And obviously, I think much more blatantly so, an attempt to get people to realize, you know, that Russia is taking this seriously. I would say that the Kuril Island exercise has to be more immediately directed at Japan, who obviously is the party that they're disputing that territory with, but certainly as part of a just a general ramping up of military preparedness and drills and things of that nature on Russia's part, this has to be seen as part of a larger picture. And I think that that it's certainly being read that way. And every time one of these drills takes place, pretty much anywhere, you see official U.S. State Department reaction to it. And U.S. officials, for example, just reading from an August 4th report from the L.A. Times, U.S. officials are deeply concerned by an aviation operation, a Russian military exercise that was conducted last week near the Ukraine border. So this is on almost pretty much a weekly basis now that we get some sort of action/reaction like this, and I think this just has to be seen as another piece in that chain of events.
Do you have any feeling as to how long this action-reaction process can go on? And does it mean that we're bound to escalate up to some sort of a serious war, or is someone going to simply say, okay, enough, we quit? Where do you think this is headed?
Well, I mean, I suppose we're at a type of equilibrium at the moment, and I guess the question is what will upset that equilibrium, and I think a lot of it depends, at least in the Ukrainian case, it depends on the Ukraine government's success or lack thereof in actually overcoming the rebels in the eastern part of the country. And if and when they're able to do that, then I think the balance of power will shift in Ukraine. And if they're not able to do that, if there is some sort of definitive defeat or repulsion of the Ukraine army or military, then I think that again would flip that balance in a different way. But at the moment, I mean, I don't see a reason, as things are going right now, why this would necessarily change. There's a lot of things that could change that, depending how they play out. I mean, if there's some sort of Russian humanitarian aid convoy, as they were planning to send into the country the other day, if that was to be attacked, for example, I mean, then that would be potentially one of those lightning rod issues. But again, barring something like that that we can't really predict, I think that the balance can be maintained for quite a while longer, and we'll see. I mean, it's not certainly in Russia's interest, and I don't think it's in Europe's interest at this point to force this to any sort of military head at the moment, to any direct confrontation. And I'm not sure that that's likely to occur in the near future, because, of course, not only, I mean, all of the other issues surrounding this, but, of course, we're also approaching over the hump of the year and heading towards winter. And historically, that's not a time when you want to start launching military offensives. So there's a lot of factors going into this, but I could certainly see the situation not boiling over in the way that a lot of people are expecting it to in the coming weeks.
I agree with you. I think they're going to play this brinkmanship role, and again, tit for tat on this, but I think everybody's pretty much resolved that this doesn't get really out of control. But I'm still waiting for mom or dad to come home and get the kids to separate and stop picking at each other. You know, they just keep on poking and poking, and everybody hopes nothing comes of it's brutally serious, and that's probably the way it works out, but it's dangerous. We talked earlier about the possible alliance between Russia and China. They may have some common denominators. They've been at each other's throats for centuries. And as you say, it's unlikely that they're going to establish a real alliance. Truth of the matter is, Russia probably has more to fear from China and vice versa than they do from the United States. Long term, over the course of the next 10 years, who's the principal enemy of China? Is it the United States? Is it more likely to be the United States? Or is it more likely to be Russia? And who's the principal enemy of Russia right now? They've got a lot of open, vacant territory, and China's got a lot of people. And they're right there side by side. They have more to fear from Russia, does Russia have more to fear from China or from the United States? What do you think?
I think the immediate threat would be obviously more from the United States. But as you say, I think long term, especially with the rise of China and presuming that that plays out and continues instead of coming to some sort of bubble popping halt, but assuming that economic rise continues, then certainly there's always the geopolitical ramifications of such an economic rise. And we're starting to see that as China takes a bigger role on the world stage. And one can only imagine what that would mean for Russian-Chinese relations and the fact that they are right there next door neighbors and competing for a lot of control and influence over the same areas, and eventually, I mean, again, right on the borders of each other, that could certainly spill into military tension. I don't see that happening anytime in the near future, but long term, I certainly think that that's something that both sides are probably
inevitable
thinking about.
When you look at it, you had a few years on there, and it seems almost inevitable the day is coming when Russia and China are going to have a confrontation that'll be serious. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm Alfred Haddisk here on Financial Survival with my guest James Corbett. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku-band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is a coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149. $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk on Financial Survival with James Corbett, and we've been talking about the conflict, well, the rising tensions between Russia and Japan, Japan and China, whether we're going to see tensions between China and Russia, and where the U.S. factors into all of this. Here's an odd little story from Ms. Shedlock's Global Economic Analysis, and the headline is U.S. to supply Kurds with Russian arms via the CIA. According to Ms. Shedlock, the story in Iraq gets more bizarre by the day. Kurdish territory in Iraq is the only pro-American territory left that the U.S. worries that it will, the Kurdish territory will splinter off into Kurdistan. Apparently, it's better to have a raging civil war as long as the country stays together in one theoretical peace. This is where the story gets really bizarre. To avoid the appearance of the U.S. giving arms to the Kurds, instead the U.S. will give the Kurds Russian-made arms via the CIA. What do you make of that? Is this just an odd little story, and that may be all it is? But first, it suggests that we can't keep any secrets in the modern age. Nobody can. And nevertheless, they're concerned about the appearance of giving arms to people they're going to give arms to. And the United States is trying to sanction Russia as giving Russian arms to the Kurds. Do you have any comment on this, or do you just shake your head?
Well, I mean, it is head shaking, but there is a lot of context that we have to understand to make sense of this story. And I think the interpretation that this is just trying to keep the country in one theoretical peace, I think, is a bit naive. That's taking the U.S. foreign policy masters at their word, that's their ultimate endgame. I have posited for some time that the real mission accomplished in Iraq is, in fact, the disintegration of the country. And it's interesting to see them funding or arming the Kurds in their fight, obviously, for their regional autonomy and potentially long-term towards the creation of Kurdistan. Even as they have also been funding the milieu in Syria that, of course, gave rise to ISIS, which the Kurds are supposedly trying to thwart with the arms that they're now going to be getting from America. I mean, it's pretty crazy when you see that all sides of this have been supplied by the U.S. And in fact, again, we only have to turn back the clock a month or two, where it was revealed that the U.S. had in fact trained a lot of the fighters that ended up going to or forming ISIS in a secret Jordanian training camp that they were running there at the end of 2011 into 2012. And again, at the time, it was posited as just some sort of blowback or what have you. But, I mean, the U.S. has been officially wringing its hands about the idea of supplying aid to the Syrian rebels for a long time because they didn't want it to fall into the wrong hands, the hands of the crazies. But, of course, again, I mean, it's just an odd, absolutely undeniable part of what they've done is to fund the radical Muslims that then cause a problem in Iraq that they again get to counter by supplying the Kurds. It looks like total chaos unless you realize that the plan is for total chaos and the disintegration of the country, or at the very least, the fighting, the endless factional fighting between various parts of Iraq, really is what is desired here, and for U.S. foreign policy interests as well as the foreign policy interests of a number of different players in the region that want to use the Iraq power vacuum as a way of getting their finger into the pie as potential regional giants in the struggle.
Are we only talking about, first off, the government, the United States government is funding apparently all sides in what is some sort of a civil war, national fragmentation or disintegration. Are we only looking at the United States trying to cause war and chaos within Iraq? Or is it that the United States is trying to cause war and chaos in a larger section of the Middle East?
Not just the Middle East. I mean, of course, over into North Africa as well. And it creates this circle of fighters that get ferried around from arena to arena, so that you had the insurgents in Iraq getting ferried out to Libya to take part in that overthrow. And once they had accomplished that, they ended up going to Syria and to take part in that. And of course, they formed the base of the radical Muslim groups that then spill over into Iraq once again. So it's strange to keep track of what's going on and to think that, of course, again, in the case of Libya, it was largely that operation was conducted largely with the support of the U.S. and, of course, with the passive, with the explicit support of NATO in terms of their bombing help when they were overthrowing Gaddafi. So this has all been taking place in that region generally. And again, I think you're right. We have to look at the bigger picture of what's going on, which is destabilization of country after country after country using these Muslim forces that seem to be just chess pieces that seem to be moved into different parts of the board in order to take it over.
We're creating chaos. That's apparent. There is a formula out of chaos, order. It can't be that chaos is the ultimate objective here, can it? Is that as much as we want, just chaos? Or do we anticipate that out of this chaos, we're going to impose a new form of order on the Middle East?
Well, I think that the ultimate long-term game plan will have to involve some sort of order, but chaos can certainly be a convenient transition, and at any rate, even if it simply remains quagmired in chaos, that can be beneficial to certain parties. So that, for example, again, I believe we've mentioned this before, but back in the 1980s, there was the explicit Israeli foreign policy goal of keeping not only dividing Iraq up, but also Syria, and keeping internal elements squabbling with each other as a way of preventing them from posing any sort of threat to Israel itself. So the longer, for example, that Iraq continues in this sort of civil war type scenario, if you can even call it that, the more that it benefits certain players like Israel that just want to make sure that these forces keep fighting each other rather than concentrating on, for example, what's happening in Gaza. That's just one example, but I mean, there are other players at that table who also benefit, I think, from that state of chaos. And you could look to someone like Saudi Arabia that, of course, has been explicitly funding and supplying a lot of these Sunni radicals for the theater in Syria and now Iraq, that also wants to assert its regional dominance. And ultimately, I mean, it would probably be better for Saudi Arabia if Sunnis were able to take over Syria and Iraq. But at any rate, again, the chaos certainly plays into their hands because it takes potential rivals off of the chessboard as they squabble with their internal rivals. So again, I think chaos is although it's unsatisfying as some sort of explanation for geopolitical events, I think it does serve certain interests, and there are people with a stake in keeping that chaos going. And ultimately, I think the long-term order will emerge from that chaos as... But, I mean, it's difficult to see what that order will be. I mean, that depends ultimately who ends up winning that regional dominance struggle. So that, I mean, for example, if it was, Saudi Arabia asserting its dominance, then we would see some sort of Sunni order imposed on the region. But I don't imagine that will ultimately transpire. But, again, I mean, different people have different ideas for what that endgame would look like.
I've speculated in an article that I wrote back a week or two ago that, and it's pure speculation, but the New World Order, to my mind, was built on the petrodollar. As long as the dollar was the only currency that could be used to purchase crude oil on the international market, they had a world reserve currency that could be used, from my perspective, as the foundation for what would become the New World Order. The dollar has lost its status as the only currency that can be used to purchase crude oil, especially in the Middle East, but anywhere really. You can now get your crude oil with almost any kind of currency. I suppose you could do it with Bitcoin if you really wanted to work at it. What's the price of a barrel of crude oil and Bitcoins right now? I don't know. We'll have to look into it. But my point is that petrodollar was a critical concept. It had to be backed by crude oil because crude oil, every nation in the world needs crude oil, practically. Is it possible that the ultimate objective for creating chaos in the Middle East, and then perhaps establishing one regional government or quasi-government, is it possible that they could set up another petrocurrency?
Well, that is, I mean, I think you're exactly right to say that the petrodollar has certainly been the force behind Pax Americana for the last 40 years, and explicitly so. I mean, this was obviously something that was engineered by Kissinger, and that's what, Saudi Arabia has been in the American fold in that time, and this has been the bedrock of international trade that has required the U.S. dollar for basically all international settlement up until very recently. And even so, I mean, still the U.S. dollar is still dominant on that in those charts. But it is coming to an end, and that end is coming slowly and in bits and pieces, but it is coming, and you see that with the growing relationship, for example, between Saudi Arabia and China, and the possibility of the Shanghai Futures Exchange pricing its crude oil futures in yuan, and all the, again, the death by a thousand paper cuts that we've talked about in various ways. So I think there is a tectonic shift that's happening that would certainly threaten to destabilize the system as it's existed and threaten the U.S. dollar hegemony, absolutely. The question of whether or not what's happening in the Middle East is explicitly or singly an expression of that particular destabilization and a desire to restabilize the dollar as the international currency, I'm not sure it's quite that simple. I think that might be one of the factors that is going into, for example, American policy decision making when it comes to the region. But again, I think there's different interests in different factions within the U.S. government itself. I mean, as we've talked about before, I think there is also the long-term plan for the destabilization of the dollar as an excuse for the further globalization of the international financial infrastructure. And for the people who are pushing that, I don't think they do want to see the U.S. dollar regain its permanence. The idea that there are a lot of competing currencies out there and the U.S. dollar doesn't have its automatic inbuilt dominance is appealing to the globalists who want to bring in the global governmental system to try to balance out these competing interests. So, I think the chaos might be more important than the restoration of order.
Well, it's a mystery, that's for sure. Whatever's going on, it's strange. And you wonder, you know, if you could clearly see what the rationale was, you could say whether it was right, wrong, or whatever. You could even say that it was rational. Even if you disagreed with it, you could say, well, this is rational. I understand what they're doing. But it's kind of a mystery. And you sit back and you look at that and say, what the heck are these people up to? And if you don't have a clue to what their fundamental idea is, what's their fundamental objective, the whole thing becomes, you wonder, are they just irrational? Are they crazy? Or what's the big secret? Do you have any suspicion as to what the big secret may be?
Well, I think we have clues from various policy documents that various think tanks have drawn up. One that has been pointed to by Tony Cardellucci at Land Destroyer and others is a policy think tank paper called "Which Path to Persia," which was talking about how to better get to Iran as part of the U.S. Foreign policy goal in the Middle East. And in order to do that, you would have to destabilize, for example, Syria, which, of course, has been done. So I think you could see this as aiming towards, ultimately, the takedown of Iran as part of a broader, even broader, aim to ultimately encircle Russia and China and to destabilize all of their partners. So in order to do that, like a domino, you have to not go directly at Iran. You would have to destabilize some of their support in the region, like in Syria and in Lebanon and places like that. So it has to be done rather peripherally. And so you could see that as one of the tendencies that's underlying what we're seeing right now. And I certainly do believe that there is the long-term game plan of encircling Russia and China, and in order to do that, I think Iran would have to be confronted at some point, but not necessarily head-on and all at once.
What do we got left? We've got about 60 seconds left. If you could briefly, who do you think, if you had to choose, which nation do you think is the key to the Middle East? Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Israel? What's the key?
Very difficult to choose one key. I guess as I say, Saudi Arabia has been the linchpin of the petrodollar system, so having Saudi Arabia on board has been important economically speaking. In terms of regional dominance, I think it's very difficult to say.
I understand that, and they may, they're not necessarily attacking their main target. They're kind of pussyfooting around the perimeter, but what is the main target? That's the question. That is a question, at least, and we're going to have to leave it for another day. This is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. James, in Japan since 2004, and thank you for being on the program. We look forward to talking to you again next Wednesday night and Thursday.
Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you,
having
James.
Me. Always a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, I'm out of here. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. Thanks for listening. The good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.
I work all night. I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's